Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-3192, United States of America versus Ricky W. Richard, Sr., Appellant. Ms. Wright for the appellant, Mr. Coleman for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. Lisa Wright, representing Mr. Richard. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal arises from a conditional guilty plea to a gun. The defendant is challenging both the denial of his suppression motion and the enhancement of his sentence under the Armed Career Criminal Act. With respect to the Fourth Amendment claim, the government argues that the police legitimately discovered the crack cocaine which led to the search warrant through two means. One, a plain view sighting from out in the public hallway, and two, through a proper protective sweep under Maryland v. Bowie. As to the argument about the plain view sighting, it's our position the court made no finding that there was such a sighting at all, that the court just found that it could have been seen from a particular vantage point. But having already found the police less credible than the civilian witnesses on the issue about the timing of the search, understandably did not want the whole case turning, I think, on Volpe's claim to have seen the crack from the hall if the case did not have to turn on that, which in the court's view it did not because of the protective sweep. So the court concluded only that Volpe could have seen the crack from that vantage point, but that that was, quote, not of significant importance in light of the protective sweep authority. To the extent the court did make a finding that the cocaine was seen from the hall, it's our position that finding was clearly erroneous. The government says that Volpe saw the crack while Mr. Richard was standing in the doorway, but that was not the basis of the district court's ruling at all. The court only talked about Volpe's view after the defendant was removed from the door and put up against the left-hand door frame. It was at that point that he said that Volpe could have seen the crack from that view. And it's our position that any claim that Volpe did see the crack while Mr. Richard was standing in the doorway would have been inherently incredible in any event, because the testimony from Volpe was that he was looking at the defendant's surprised face, recognizing him from the photograph, and immediately he was pulled out of the doorframe. So that theory cannot sustain any finding. Regarding whether Volpe actually saw the crack while the defendant was up against the doorframe and Officer Jones was holding the door open, this was the court's theory of how Volpe could have seen the crack, but the government is not making the claim that that is how Volpe saw the crack. According to the government, there is no evidence in this record at all to support such a finding to the extent the court made it. So the only possible finding the court made here, we don't think it found one at all, but to the extent it made one, it found the vantage point when the door was being held open and Mr. Volpe was being handcuffed. The government says that's not what Volpe testified to. So I think the whole factual finding about the plain view sighting cannot sustain this ruling. So moving to the protective sweep question, the government is not claiming that this sweep would have been legitimate as a sort of second type of buoy sweep, a reasonable suspicion that the premises was harboring dangerous third parties. That's actually what the court found, but the government is not defending the ruling on that basis. They're arguing that it satisfies Bowie's first prong, which permits, without any reasonable suspicion, officers to look, quote, look in closets and other spaces immediately adjoining the place of arrest. And it's our position first that Bowie does not authorize even looking in the door here to the extent you had to hold the door open to do that, because Bowie is about, once you are legitimately on a premises with an arrest warrant to arrest someone, how can you safely secure the interior of that premises where you're completing the arrest so you can depart the premises. Bowie is not about justifying intrusions across a threshold when everybody is outside, and to the extent the door was held open to look in the living room, that's what happened here. Our second argument is that looking in means looking in, not entering. We recognize
it depends on what you're seeing, doesn't it?
Well, if you saw the crack when you looked in, you could get a search warrant. But what we're saying, Jones did not see the crack when he looked in. It's our position that in Bowie, it would have been okay for the police to have entered the basement that Bowie emerged from if looking in really meant enter. We recognize this court's Thomas and Ford cases are against us on that question, but we want to preserve that for the Supreme Court review as to the interpretation of Bowie. Third, even if Bowie's first prong does justify actual entry into areas adjacent to the place of arrest, it does not justify entering an exterior threshold as occurred here. Again, Bowie is about how do we make the premises safe for the police to effectuate an arrest once they're legitimately across the threshold. If Bowie's apprehension was at the top of the stairs, as the government claims, then defendant's apprehension was clearly in the public hallway here. The government tries to say the appellant was apprehended in the living room, but if he was apprehended in the living room, then Bowie would have been apprehended where he first emerged as well, and was ordered up the stairs. So they kind of can't have it both ways there. In any event, even under Bowie's second prong, it's clear that a sweep is to last, quote, no longer than it takes to complete the arrest and depart the premises. Here, defendant departed the premises and was arrested immediately when he was pulled out to the hall, and the police were never on the premises, so I don't think Bowie can justify it there. And I would even argue that if you can, once everyone's outside in this hallway, if you're going to treat the living room as adjacent, then it seems living room of apartment 16 is adjacent for Bowie purposes, and it seems like all the other living rooms off the hallway are equally adjacent. I don't think the government would argue that. As we argued also that even if you were allowed to enter the living room normally, here there was no need to because a visual sweep had already been done by Officer Jones and he had not seen the crack. And finally, even if Jones was allowed to enter, even though he'd already visually swept, there was no justification for the second independent entry by Montgomery County once a physical and visual sweep had been done in the living room. And I think it's undisputed that Jones and Montgomery County both claimed that they actually went back into the bedrooms and looked under the beds and such. Clearly, that was illegal, and that extended Bowie beyond anything I think anyone is defending here. So it's Jones testified that Montgomery County did not find Montgomery County there in the living room pointing at the crack until he had returned from the illegal, clearly illegal part of his search. So even if Montgomery County was allowed to make a second entry, they didn't do it until Jones's sweep had already exceeded any Bowie authority. And so I think under any of these theories, the Bowie sweep cannot be upheld. So we'd ask the court to vacate the judgment of a conditional guilty plea and reverse the denial of appellant suppression motion. As to my sentencing claim, it's our position that the court committed plain error under Williams, this court's Williams decision, and defense counsel was ineffective when they failed to determine whether the government could prove the D.C. Code robberies appellant's prior D.C. Code robberies qualified as ACCA predicates, and the government could not. First, the government is wrong to suggest this was invited error. If this was invited error, it would also be invited error if the court had sentenced appellant as a career offender. He was warned wrongly in the plea letter that he could be a career offender. At the plea colloquy, the court told him you might be a career offender. None of that was true, but defendant agreed, oh yes, I understand, I might be a career offender. If he'd been sentenced as a career offender, I don't think there'd be any question that that could be reviewed for plain error, and this is the same situation. The government says, we're stuck with our bargain, but you cannot bargain away proper application of the guidelines and statutes except for one way, and that is through an 11C1C plea. That is the way you can bargain away the law. You cannot bargain away proper application of the law other than through that. So, and as the court told the defendant at the time of the plea, I have to make my own independent decision. Everyone knew that. Everyone knew this term was not binding. And even if you could bargain away in this manner, certainly there was no knowing waiver here where the government sort of misstated or the requirements of ACCA such that it sounded like the defendant met them. They said in their factual proffer, quote, as the defendant has three prior convictions for crimes punishable by imprisonment for more than 1 year, unquote, the ACCA penalties apply. So given that that was what appellant was being told, you cannot say he knowingly admitted he had violent felonies or knowingly understood what ACCA required.
He did acknowledge, didn't he, that he had two convictions for armed robbery, right?
For robbery. For robbery. D.C. Code robbery, right.
And the record indicates, does it not, that he... that those robberies were effected at knife point.
Well, one of them says records reflect that mm-hmm. the defendant robbed someone at knife point, and I would say not objecting to that doesn't really say anything because the records do reflect that, the police reports, etc. reflect that that's what actually happened. That was the government's version of events originally. As to the other one where it says he actually did do this, we've argued, and I think we're clearly correct, especially in light of the in re sealed case decision last week, that the question is not what did the defendant do or admit he did, but what did defendant admit at the time of the plea? What was the factual basis for the plea? And the PSR in this case does not say anything about that. So it doesn't answer the Shepherd question.
I'm looking at the PSR at 8 and 9. I think I've got the right one. In which the two offenses are described. Isn't it? Am I in the right place? 8 and 9 of the PSR? Mm-hmm. Which is actually called the pre-sentence investigation report?
Right.
Okay. So at 8, it says in the middle, near the end of part 28, before 29, the defendant and an accomplice robbed a victim, taking $21 at knife point. But then the next page, it says, records reflect that the defendant, assisted by an accomplice, robbed from a victim at knife point. Now, is there any difference in those two? I mean, doesn't records reflect implicit in every one of these paragraphs? That's, how else would they know this?
I don't think they are the same, actually, because I think you could not object to paragraph 30, the records reflect, and not really be admitting anything about what actually happened. I concede that by not objecting to paragraph 28, the defendant is conceding that an accomplice robbed a victim,
yeah,
taking 21 at knife point. First of all, that's, even if that's enough for the government here, that's only one, not two. But
right.
That's not the question under Shepherd.
But what is the possible basis in paragraph 28 for saying he robbed the victim at knife point? Or are you saying that the basis is his colloquy? He said that?
I'm saying that the only issue for the district court under Shepherd is, mm-hmm, what was the factual basis of the guilty plea, not what actually happened. And so
right,
this is telling us what the defendant is now saying happened. In fact,
both paragraphs.
Well, in 28, he's saying what actually happened. In 30, he's saying that the records reflect, you know, what the government's.
The defendant didn't say that, did he?
Pardon?
The defendant didn't say records reflect.
No, I'm saying by not objecting, I understand this court's law to be that if he doesn't object, the court can accept these as true.
Okay.
And I understand that, but I'm saying that they don't answer the relevant question. And this tells us what the defendant is saying now, or what in the case of paragraph 30, what the government's theory was, I think. But the government has also proffered the original pre-sentence reports from Superior Court, which give it yet another version that the defendant gave of what actually happened, but none of those are relevant. It really doesn't matter, and I think the sealed case says that very clearly. We may look to no other materials, even if they might shed light on what the defendant probably did or probably admitted to. And these descriptions in the PSR.
Here we're dealing with a plea agreement, right, in which, pardon me, there was acknowledgement and consideration. Right? The defendant acknowledged these offenses and received consideration in the reduction of the charge.
He acknowledged that he had three prior felonies.
And that he was liable to be sentenced under the.
He said he understood the lack
okay.
applied.
Now, the end of your brief, I'm trying to, not clear as to what you think happened or what you think should happen. At the end of the brief, you say, for these reasons, appellant must be granted a resentencing without the enhanced penalties of the ACCA, right?
Mm-hmm.
And presumably that means then without a plea agreement.
No, the plea.
You want to keep the benefit, but not the side of the bargain and not the other?
Well, you know, when you enter into, the government chose to enter into a non-binding agreement that ACCA applied. They well knew when they did that it might turn out that ACCA didn't apply. If the court here had done what it should have done under Williams, it would have discovered that ACCA didn't apply.
Wait a minute. Why would the court undertake on its own initiative to question a fact stipulated by defense?
Well, because Williams says that it does, that
this
has that independent.
That wasn't a plea agreement case.
Well.
Right? When there's no plea agreement, the court has to do that. I understand.
Well, I mean,
here the parties have entered into an agreement And there's no obvious reason why the court should question that.
If it was an 11C1C agreement, that would be absolutely correct. The court can choose to accept that or not accept it, but you cannot bargain away the correct application of the guidelines. You just cannot. The court has an independent obligation. They could agree that Mr. Wichard is subject to life in prison under the three strikes law. They could agree to a lot of things. And the district court is not, if he realizes the error, and Williams says he's supposed to look for it when he sees DC code robbery. That's a red flag. He's supposed to look. There would be other situations, I think, where the...
This person is not uncounseled. It seems to me that you've got a stronger case when you talk about counsel than you have about the court.
Well, I agree we also have an ineffective assistance claim, but I think under Williams we have shown clear error as well and also prejudice. Because, in fact, if you look at the records that are available, it turns out that these robberies were lesser included offense pleas to count C that does not exist anywhere, and therefore, under In Re Sealed Case, it's clearly possible that these were not... because they were not necessarily, did not necessarily rest on the required fact, then they are not qualifying, they were not qualifying at the time.
How do we know that counsel didn't know everything that you've told us, the unavailability of the records included?
Yes.
And say, this is a good deal.
Uh-huh.
Take it.
Well.
We can go this other route, but, you know, I think you're going to do worse if we do it.
I mean, I don't think it's right. I don't think that it would be ethical, actually, for him to say he's ACCA eligible when he's not, to have him sign that deal. He could have gone to the government and said...
No. Assuming the defendant, as far as we know, or as far as counsel knows, has two offenses that involved robbery at knife point, okay?
The defendant
may not be right about what he was convicted of, okay?
Say that again? I'm sorry.
The defendant may not be correct about what the actual conviction was, but the defendant leaves counsel with the information that these were robberies at knife point.
Right? Well, I mean, if counsel...
But the records are unavailable.
Right. If counsel knew the records were unavailable, then he knows, as you say, that he's not ACCA eligible. He might nevertheless think this is a good deal to 15 years. The way to accomplish that is through an 11C1C plea, not to have everybody inform the court falsely that the man is ACCA eligible. I mean, first of all, that's highly risky.
Well, no, he doesn't think it's falsely. He does. He just.
He knows it's false if he's investigated. He knows it's false. He's not ACCA eligible.
All he knows is that the records aren't available.
That makes him not ACCA eligible.
So there's no way that the defendant can insist that he did this at knife point and get it, and be subject to ACCA?
I will say this. The only way I can think of that could be done is if the plea agreement included the correct Shepherd factual admission, which would be that the factual basis of my pleas were violent felonies through knife point. If you admitted what Shepherd requires you to admit in the plea, I think that would be okay and could, it still wouldn't bind the court, to be honest, but at least the safer course would be 11C1C. And I also think it's a little unseemly to have the defendants, you know, claiming to remember what happened. I think it's better to just say, we're not sure, and let's do an 11C1C. But I think it could be done the way you're saying, if the proper admissions were made. Here, not only was the factual basis not admitted, but the defendant was actually misinformed as to what. He wasn't even told that violent felonies were required, let alone admitted that the factual basis of his plea was violent. So that's our position. And we think also the ineffective assistance claim for the reasons.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
If as between resentencing with no plea agreement and...
You say vacate the plea?
If we vacate the plea, pardon me, no. If we say that the enhanced penalties of ACCA are not applicable, or at least is not proven to be applicable, mm-hmm. then the whole plea agreement is vacated.
I don't think that's correct. I mean, we're not saying that the plea was the result of ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't.
You're not.
No. I think we're saying he was ineffective in not objecting at sentencing. I don't think we're claiming that.
That's a distinction that included me.
Well, he's.
Are you sure about that?
Yes, because he may have not done the greatest job in the world at the plea, but by agreeing to this non-binding fact, mistaken fact, because it was non-binding, I don't think the defendant can actually say he's prejudiced by it. He shouldn't have been prejudiced by it because it was non-binding. I mean, he made a mistake that didn't really matter. It shouldn't have mattered.
Let's talk about prejudice. That's your burden, isn't it?
Yes.
And what have you shown by way of prejudice?
On the ineffectiveness or the plain error? Both?
Let's start with it.
Okay.
Start with the plain error. No, go to ineffectiveness. Go to.
Okay. Well, I guess they're kind of related because what I'm saying is that to the extent that we can't win plain error because he failed to object, we would have won if he had objected. We've shown prejudice. So the prejudice is that in Williams, for example, this court said that there was no prejudice shown because the defendant had not proffered any records or anything at all before us to suggest any likelihood the district court would have assigned Williams a different base offense level had it first conducted the proper inquiry into these robbery convictions. And I note in Williams, you know, Your Honor said that wasn't a plea, but there were PSR allegations, and the thing was being treated by probation as a robbery and as a crime of violence, and the defendant didn't object. So, I mean, this court nevertheless thought district court had an independent obligation to look into it, and I think the same situation is here. But Williams went into some detail.
That's the baseline, and then the question is, when there's an overlay of an agreement, whether that changes.
Well, I do think that because of Mathis and this unique burden that the government bears in this sort of odd D.C. Code statute, it's the only one, I think, where the government does have to dig out these records, and the court and everybody else. I mean, Mathis has been on the books for like 15 years. Williams has been around. There's Gabriel. I mean, everybody should know that we need to investigate this. You don't just assume. But Williams went into a lot of detail about what defendants have to show.
Because of the retention policy at Superior Court, which I think is 10 years, what that means really is that if it's more than 10 years, the government's got to insist on a colloquy, in your view, right? A colloquy
either
that
get
incorporates
an admission of the factual basis if we all want to pretend that the defendant can actually know that, or better yet, I think.
Well, he can know the fact. I mean, he'll know whether it was at knife point. You may not know what the...
You know what actually happened, but he can't... I think it's not that reliable for him to tell us what the factual basis of the guilty plea was. And I note here also, count A. We had count A, count B, and count C. The government's original count A in the complaint, which was an armed robbery complaint, I believe, armed, did include stealthy seizure or snatching as one of its theories. So, I mean...
Disjunctive, though.
Yes. But I'm saying... And so then they charge armed robbery in count B, and then when they drop it down to this, you know, this lesser included offense, which there is no written record of what that was, well, I mean, there's no reason to doubt that it went back to one of the government's original lesser theories, which was the snatching. So,
all right, we digress.
I'm sorry. Anyway, Williams explains that all the defendant doesn't need to establish conclusively that the sentence would be different. It doesn't need to demonstrate, quote, that it's more likely than not the sentence will change. He must offer some reason to suspect the district court's error resulted in an incorrect sentence. And these files I'm talking about do show that because, as I say, if you go and look at it, it turns out that he pled to a lesser included offense, count C. Therefore, necessarily, the government, he's not ACCA eligible because there's no...
Is he liable to this sentence without ACCA?
Is he...
Without ACCA, is the sentence he got within the range?
No, it is 7.5 years above the statutory maximum. Mm-hmm. And then the alternative Your Honor was talking about, if he's just ineffective at sentencing, which is what we're saying, then the remedy is, I mean, just as if the district court had discovered this on its own. Everybody knew there was that risk. The district court could have said, wait a minute, is this guy really ACCA-able? Do you have any records that show? I mean, a lot of defense lawyers do this, so the judge would have had every reason to ask, and if they couldn't come forward, the guy would not be ACCA-able. He'd be at a 10-year sentence. And the government says, oh, we could have gotten out of the deal then. That's completely wrong. They cannot get out of their bargain because a non-binding term that the court discovers does not apply. That they say, you know, green is blue, and the court says, oh, no, it's not. They can't get out of the deal. And the fact that defense counsel would be the one that would discover it shouldn't make any difference. They can't rescind the agreement. And the notion that it's a mutual mistake, it's a non-material term. It's just the parties sort of putting it out there. A lot of things go into plea agreements, and everybody knows that the court warns defendants at the plea colloquy, don't be relying on anybody telling you what the calculation is going to be. We don't know anything until I see the pre-sentence report and I make my own independent judgment.
When the PSR is presented and there's no objection.
When the PSR had no objection?
There's no objection to the PSR. You want us to say, well, all he failed to object to was the proposition that records reflect.
As to one, that's correct. Yeah. As to the other, he did admit, by not objecting.
In context, that's a very difficult proposition.
Because if
defense counsel was on top of this game, mm-hmm. right, he would have made the point that all they're stipulating to is that records reflect, and that doesn't make him ACCA eligible.
Well, I mean, they all thought he was ACCA eligible, yeah. So, I mean, but nobody thought, nobody was realizing, I mean, these statements in the PSR, if they were worded, if they said what the factual basis was under Shepard, then a lack of objection, I think, would be a much better case for the government, because then the court could have.
But your case has to be that everybody erred here.
That everybody?
Everybody erred. The defendant, the defense counsel,
oh, yes.
And the court.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone erred.
Yes, and the guy ended up with 7.5 extra years, at least, because of it. And I think it's ineffective assistance, it's plain error, and for all those reasons, we ask that the case be remanded for resentencing at a minimum for a hearing on ineffectiveness claim.
What would be the question? What factual question would be put at that
Well,
point?
And the government has made the argument that, look, if defense counsel had figured this out at sentencing, we would have been able to undo the deal. I've addressed that. They've also said if he had figured it out before the plea, he wouldn't have gotten if he'd figured out that he wasn't ACCA eligible before the plea, then we would have done one of three things. We would have either, sort of forced this. I view what they're saying as making 11C1C plea, because they're saying we'd make him waive,
right.
You know, this problem. Or two, we would, go to trial with overwhelming evidence. Or three, we'd make him plead to higher charges. And we don't dispute that the guy had a lot of exposure and a lot of incentive to plead guilty.
So what's the question on remand?
So the point is that if we think it's correct that if he had discovered it and brought it to the government's attention, and frankly, they should have known also, that the 11C1C plea would have been negotiated. And the question on remand would be, what would the deal have been? And this court has remanded for that sort of.
Is that any different than vacating the deal and letting them renegotiate?
Than vacating the sentence?
The agreement as well and letting them renegotiate.
Yeah, that would.
It'd be the same thing, effectively.
Well, if the court found. I guess the question is, what is the remedy? I don't think you have to undo the deal for any of these remedies.
There has to be a factual inquiry to make a remand. Well, not.
Yeah, the factual inquiry, I think, would be what remedy. How much was the defendant harmed here if the lawyer had found this mistake before the plea and had brought it to everyone's attention? Things would have happened differently. And
you say it's 7.5 years is the harm.
Well,
and the government's going to say no because we would have gone to trial.
Well, maybe they would have come up with a 13-year deal. I mean, I don't know. But that would be the question on remand, and then that would be the remedy that would be imposed to remedy the ineffective assistance.
So the court's going to make a finding that but for the error, they would have come to such and such an agreement?
I think that would be the inquiry. I don't think that's necessary, though, because the error here, the ineffectiveness is in not catching it before sentencing. And, yes, he is entitled to keep his deal and get the 10-year maximum.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Nick Coleman for the United States. I'd like to address the suppression issue first, and with respect to the finding by the Court that Detective Volpe saw the drugs from the door in plain view. Appellant continues to insist.
What page is that?
Page of the
appendix, the finding. Where's the finding?
The finding was made at three different pages, Your Honor. With the Court's indulgence, I'll look that up. The court specifically made that finding at pages 9 through 10, 18, and 24 of the transcript. In addition, in support of that finding at page 9, the court discounted the value of the Russell videotape. I don't think there's any dispute here between appellant and appellee over what the court's language was. The question was, what did the court's language mean? Appellant claims here that by using the term could have seen, perhaps the district court wasn't really making a finding. It was just saying something provisionally, or as appellant insists in his reply brief, perhaps he was simply indirectly justifying crediting the officers for other purposes. I think actually that the much easier way to look at this is that A, the district court said what it said, and after all, this was the first finding it made for a reason. And also, if you look at the actual factual findings which the court was being asked to make, with respect to the protective sweep, the court was being asked to make a finding as to whether the officers actually entered the apartment immediately upon apprehending appellant. Cornell Boyd, one of the defense witnesses, claimed that, in fact, the officers had closed the door and waited for over 2 minutes before they re-entered the apartment and then swept the apartment. The district court specifically discounted that claim. The court was also asked to make a finding as to whether or not the officers could see the crack in the living room at the time when appellant answered the door. And here, because the question was, could they see it, the court said they could have seen it. So that, we submit, is the proper way to read what the court was doing here. Otherwise, it really makes no sense why Judge Walton would have spent as much time as he did discussing this issue and also discounting that videotape evidence. I'd like to also respond to a couple of the arguments that my colleague just made about that particular finding. First of all, the idea that here the court was only crediting Detective Volpe's view of the crack after appellant had been shoved to the side. One thing to keep in mind here is that movement took a matter of probably less than a second. In other words, appellant opened the door, stood there in front of the officers, he was grabbed and began to be shoved to the side. It's really splitting hairs here to say that somehow the court was narrowly focusing only on some specific point in time when Detective Volpe could have seen into the apartment. After appellant was pushed to the side, this could all have happened essentially simultaneously. As appellant answered the door and stood there, Detective Volpe could either have seen it immediately, as soon as appellant opened the door to his right, or just as Officer Jones began pulling him to the side. With respect to the issue of the protective sweep, here, of course, there's no factual dispute, except for one thing. Appellant, both in his reply brief and here at argument, claims that focuses only on Officer Jones' sweep of the apartment. In other words, saying that because Officer Jones didn't see the crack cocaine during his sweep, that the protective sweep really doesn't extend as a justification for the discovery of the crack. But the court specifically said that it found that they, the officers, plural, swept the apartment. In other words, crediting Detective Volpe's claim that he swept the apartment at the same time as Officer Jones. And he clearly said that he saw the drugs even before he entered that apartment. So, in fact, this protective sweep issue really boils down to whether the officers were entitled even to see inside this a living room immediately behind appellant. It doesn't really matter for purposes of this case whether the officers were entitled to enter that living room or whether they could only look in it, as appellant says, because if you looked in it, it was quite clear and there's no dispute an officer could have seen those drugs. So regardless of whether Thomas was correctly decided, and we submit that it was, it doesn't really matter. Because in this case, that sweep, whether it was visual or physical, would have uncovered those drugs. That's exactly what happened, and accordingly, the motion to suppress was correctly denied. I'd like to address, at this point, the sentencing issue. And first of all, appellant says that the fact that he agreed to an ACCA sentence is essentially of no moment because that plea agreement didn't bind the court. Whether it bound the court, however, is not the issue. The fact is it bound the parties. That was their understanding. That was the agreement between these two parties. So even though this wasn't an 11
well, but here when the defense says didn't bind the court, they mean that there that the background law applies in which the court has an independent obligation.
Your Honor, two responses.
So the question is not whether the court's bound by this, but whether it's discharge of its obligation.
Yes, but Your Honor, that I think, however, that raises the question of what the district court's obligation was in this case. Here, it had a plea agreement and an express.
We're starting with Williams, right? That's where.
Yes.
That's all we know so far going into this case is Williams.
Well, starting with Williams, which I would submit isn't really apposite to this case, because in Williams there was no plea agreement. There was no stipulation in the agreement that the ACCA would apply. The defendant was found guilty after trial. There was no agreement as to the sentence, no agreement as to the plea, no bargain whatsoever, and hence the parties were not representing anything to the court. Also in Williams, this court said that the PSR contained no factual statements about the predicate offenses, none whatsoever. That is a difference between that case and here.
You need to rely on both of the predicate offenses here, and one of them, as Ms. Wright points out, just says what the records reflect.
Yes, Your Honor. I think here we are reading far too much into the words records reflect that. In the context of this PSR, it's clear that what the PSR writer was trying to do was to describe the offenses and what happened. The fact that in one it said records reflect, and the other it said exactly what happened. Here,
but
again,
in the one where it says exactly what happened, isn't that also the one as to which he testified that's what happened?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure.
Didn't the defendant in his colloquy say as to the offense described in paragraph 28 that in fact that was at knife point?
My understanding, Your Honor, and again, we don't have the original plea colloquies from the Superior Court. The old PSRs that were prepared in each of those cases, in fact, in both of those, and these were sorry, the defendant's statements to the probation officer post-plea but prior to his sentencing in the Superior Court. In each case, he denied actually having a knife. These were the descriptions he gave, but his description of the offenses was that he, in fact, directly confronted and essentially demanded payment or demanded money from the victim. Or I think in one of them, he accompanied, he said, his friend, and he told his friend, don't give us any trouble. He told the victim, don't give us any trouble. Just hand over what you owe. That's what I recall. In each of these cases, back then, he denied they were at knife point. Notably, here before the district court, when he had the opportunity to object to the PSR and its description of both offenses as being conducted at knife point, he made no objection and, in fact, volunteered further information. He said that, in fact, the victims were only other drug dealers, and at sentencing, his counsel argued that that should mitigate the circumstances. So, in fact, far from objecting or...
All right, so then Ms. Wright comes back and says all he acknowledged was that the records reflect.
Well, Your Honor, again, it's his obligation at that point if he wants to, if he disagrees with something in the PSR, he has every right to do so under Rule 32.
But he doesn't disagree that the records reflect.
Well, and once he has done so, of course, his entire claim here on appeal is that the records don't so reflect, that there are insufficient records. It was his obligation, whether one wants to say that I didn't really rob him at knife point, or one wants to say, as appellant now claims, well, Superior Court records are incomplete because they destroyed them 10 years ago, he should have objected to that factual statement, regardless of whether one calls it a description specifically of the offense or only of the record saying what the offense was. He should have raised that objection then, and the district court, under this court's decision in U.S. v. Sorrow, says that the district court simply does not err when it relies on factual statements that are unobjected to in the PSR.
When the PSR says records reflect knife point, what records could those be?
Your Honor, presumably it'd be the records of the conviction. Again, it's not a particularly
Which records were destroyed and which survive?
I don't claim to know specifically what the PSR writer of that particular report was referring to. In other words, which records did she have? Well, they could have been any number of records.
Okay, but assuming that she had access to all the records that actually still exist, what would they be?
From what I have seen and from what appellant's counsel provided to the court, it looks like there are docket entries. I believe there is a complaint still in existence, an indictment. There are documents which we acknowledge what appears to be existing in the Superior Court files, or at least what appellant was able to find in the Superior Court files. If this challenge had been timely raised and there weren't an issue of a plea agreement on top of it, but if this had been like Williams, in other words, a sentencing subject to no agreement, and a sentencing in which a challenge had actually been raised, Shepard would certainly have restricted the court's use of any of the records that are currently existing in the Superior Court files, because they just aren't the kind, because you just don't have the statement by the defendant on the record in there as to what he did.
Well, let me follow up on that, because I'm not sure I understand your argument. It seems to me, if we follow the categorical approach, that even if now defendant says, a knife was used, that's not what we can look at. It's not the actual facts here, but actually, the facts that we are permitted to look at in determining whether this was a violent felony. And I understood your brief to be saying those records don't exist.
Yes, Your Honor, those records don't exist. But I think that the issue Your Honor is touching on actually is somewhat different. If, in fact, appellant had, let's say he had, in fact, affirmatively stated at his plea colloquy with respect to his old convictions, I conducted those at knife point. He then essentially would have informed the district court unambiguously those predicate offenses were ACCA predicate offenses. The question of what the government would have been able to prove had a challenge been raised is a different one from whether the predicate offenses actually were predicate offenses. It's a procedural versus a factual claim. Now, granted, if the proper procedures had been followed, the government might not have been able to meet its burden. But here we're asking about plain error review at best. Because we're asking the question, essentially, was there substantial prejudice in it, and also whether or not there was a miscarriage of justice, here everything in the record that we have suggests that these were, in fact, violent felonies.
But so are you relying then just on the fact that there's an agreement, or are you making a different argument, which goes to prong four of the, in other words, that even though there was error, it was plain, there was prejudice, but is that the argument that you're making?
Both, Your Honor. In all of these cases, all of the above, essentially here, because you have a district court relying on an agreement between the parties that the ACCA applies. You also have a district court relying on a PSR that says that these were predicate offenses, which is unobjected to.
But that agreement tells the defendant something that is, in fact, inaccurate. So how can that be a basis for saying there's no prejudice here?
Your Honor, I don't know that the agreement actually tells the defendant something inaccurate to this extent. First of all, it says two things. That agreement says the ACCA applies. It references that statute. We don't believe that in fact, is inaccurate. We, in fact, think that what exists in the record indicates that these were, in fact, violent felony robberies.
We know what we can look at under the ACCA to determine whether these were violent felonies. We don't have that documentation.
Yes,
so
Your
why
Honor.
Isn't that inaccurate?
No, Your Honor. And the reason why is that we're not on direct review of a challenge that was, in fact, presented to the district court. To use the language which this court just used in In Re Sealed Case, this court said that under Shepard, where there was a direct challenge, it could not ask the question, what was probably the case with respect to the oath. We are here not on direct review of preserved error.
Okay, so your argument is that In Re Sealed Case doesn't apply here?
That's correct, Your Honor. In Re Sealed Case does not apply because we're not asking the same question, which In Re Sealed Case did. We're not at that procedural stage. We're at a stage where first a defendant entered into this agreement. Also, he didn't raise an objection to the PSR. He didn't object to the sentence in the district court. And so because of that, we believe he's actually just waived this claim completely. But even if he hasn't, he must meet plain error review. And there, the burden is not on the government to show whether it could have met its burden of proof. The burden is on appellant to show both that there was substantial prejudice and that there was a miscarriage of justice. And we don't think that appellant can do that. Notably, as we pointed out in our brief, he has never once actually claimed that he pleaded to something other than a violent felony in the Superior Court. He relies solely on the fact that after 10 years, these records were destroyed. That is the only thing that he says. He never once says that he was improperly or illegally sentenced under the ACCA, only that if only I had raised this claim, the government would not have been able to prove it, and then I wouldn't have been sentenced under the ACCA. That, of course, still begs the question of what about his actual plea agreement? We actually believe that agreement did bind him. It did bind him. It would have been a breach of the agreement for him to try to essentially get out of his part of the bargain, to say that the government has to give up all of its evidence and all of these much higher penalties, but now I'm going to be sentenced under something which the government clearly would never have allowed me to plead to only, which is a 10-year maximum sentence as opposed to a 15-year mandatory minimum. If there are no further questions, the government would respectfully ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you. Ms. Wright, you need 1 minute. That's all we have left.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. Case is submitted.
Thank you.